Really?
From the last five rows of the middle six.
Play anything at this time.
Proceeding in the
present address, Mr. Kaplan.
They say things are lost to history. But every once in a while, things lost are found again.
1402 60th Street.
This is the sound of 32 citizens losing their jobs and their reputations. 32 Philadelphians, 32 public school teachers.
Are you presently a teacher in the Philadelphia school system, Mr. Kaplan?
I am.
Where do you teach?
I teach at the John Bartram High School.
At the Ferguson School.
The Baldwin Public School.
The Abraham Lincoln High School.
Clara Barton Elementary School.
Stetson Junior High School, sir.
Hunter Elementary.
I'm at Sulzberger Junior High School.
Watts High School, where I'm now teaching.
Were you...
One day, these people were living normal lives, teaching, raising kids. The next day, they were enemies, traitors. Their names and their pictures and their home addresses plastered across the city, underlined with a dangerous accusation.
Now, I have asked you a very simple question. It doesn't take any Philadelphia lawyer to understand it. Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
These recordings are from November 1953. A congressional committee had come to Philadelphia to investigate the so-called communist threat. You might have read about this committee in some long-ago history class. The House Un-American Activities Committee, often known as HUAC.
May I make a point, please? I am not a communist.
Unless you are a subpoenaed. If I leave it to our client to concur with you.
During HUAC's brief stay in Philadelphia, the committee's members spent a lot of their time questioning teachers. Teachers who would soon be flushed out of the city's public school system.
Have you ever been one?
May I finish my statement, sir?
No, just answer my question. Have you ever been one?
I can't tell you a whole lot about these audio recordings of these hearings. We don't know who made them, and we don't know why. They've never been shared publicly before. This audio artifact somehow ended up in the hands of a woman named Judy Gandy. Her father was one of the accused teachers that you just heard.
I don't know how I have them, honestly.
Judy found these reels, literally old school reel-to-reels, at her home in Arizona.
I've never talked with anybody about them. And they're just sitting in a closet.
One day, a college professor named Nick Talutis called her to talk about her dad getting caught up in this McCarthy-era purge. He's writing a book, so they chatted.
And toward the end of the conversation, she said to me that she happened to have these reel-to-reels, and would I be interested in hearing them and seeing them? And I said, well, yeah, of course. So she put them in the mail.
Nick gave the tapes to a guy in the Philly suburbs who digitizes old, obscure audio. And all of a sudden, like that, we now have this piece of history that we never knew we had. This is not a full record of the hearings, but it is, as far as we know, the only audio that exists of an extraordinary moment in Philadelphia history. And I have to say that it feels like these tapes showed up at the right time. It's been 70 years, 7 decades, since these teachers were interrogated, questioned about their beliefs and their political thinking. But a lot of the social currents that brought us to that point in the early 1950s are flowing today. Or maybe they never went away. We in this country have a long fascination with the politics of teachers, what they believe, what they say. Today, maybe we don't ask them about communism, but we ask about the books they assign or the sex education curriculum they use or what they post on social media. In other words, we're still asking and watching.
Maybe somebody will give us a little information pretty soon if we keep after enough of them.
This is Schooled. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. On this episode, a story from Philadelphia's past. The suspension of 32 teachers, all with alleged ties to the Communist Party. We are going to bring you to the moment when the government plucked these teachers from obscurity and paraded them before the city, and really the entire nation. Then we're going to explore the fallout, the lives lived after the Red Scare blew through town, and the lessons that this story still holds today.
I think it has value if people are reminded, but the consequence of that is, what do they do with that? If you are reminded and you do nothing, then what's the point?
Part 1, The Local. Our story begins long before the Red Scare and the McCarthy era, in the height of the Great Depression, the early 1930s.
This was sort of, you know, a good example of striking while the iron is hot.
Again, that's Nick Taludis, who shared these recordings with me. He's a professor at the College of New Jersey, and he's writing a book on early teacher union efforts in Philadelphia.
You've got a situation in which salaries are being cut, the Depression is all around.
And for Philadelphia's salary-strapped teachers, there really was no group to advocate on their behalf. Teachers at the time had professional associations, but
when the salary cut happened in late 32 and into 33, those organizations didn't really do much to try to fight it.
So instead, a group of Philadelphia teachers tried a new strategy. They formed Local 192 of the American Federation of Teachers. For the first time, Philadelphia had a version of a teachers' union. The idea that teachers could be part of the broader labor movement was pretty groundbreaking at that time. But unions could not yet bargain for things like salaries and benefits. And even at this union's peak, only about a tenth of Philadelphia teachers were members. So in function, Local 192 was really an advocacy group, but it was an aggressive one.
The people that got involved with this union were the idealists. These were the ones who really wanted to change things.
For instance, the union activists fought for school desegregation at a time when black teachers could only teach in all-black elementary schools. They also dug in on economic issues like salary, working conditions, and especially job protection.
So, for example, women teachers were often fired if they got pregnant. And there was clearly discrimination in hiring and firing and promoting and retaining and so forth black teachers.
That is the voice of John Ehrenreich. His parents, Frida and Joe, were active members of Local 192, and their stories are pretty typical of the people who joined this union. Both were children of immigrants, raised in Philadelphia. Joe's family was fairly apolitical. Frida's was the opposite. Her father wrote for a radical Jewish newspaper before eventually opening a dry goods store, and he became Joe's political mentor.
They would sit in the room behind the store drinking tea the Russian way with a cube of sugar between the teeth and in the glass of tea and talk politics. And it was my mother's father who politicized my father.
Joe and Frida married in 1934, just as this union effort was getting underway. Sylvia and Sam Drayson married a few years later in 1937. I talked to their son, David Drayson.
So how did your parents meet, by the way?
No idea. But I assume it was the teachers' union.
Sylvia and Sam were also children of immigrants, young, politically minded, maybe a little bit intellectually restless.
Oh, they thought they were building a better world.
Sylvia and Sam and Frida and Joe were all part of this bigger group of committed union activists. It's not easy to find a real shorthand way to describe all of them, but if there's a current running through the early days of this union, it's one of hope and maybe a little naive optimism. David keeps a postcard that his mom Sylvia wrote to her father from the 1948 Progressive Party Convention in Philadelphia.
So I'll try to read it. "Well, Philadelphia put on a show last night like I've never seen, Dad. I wish you had been here."
It's a quick note, but I think it captures the spirit of these activists. And it also captures Sylvia's hopes for the future.
"It was not cheap politicians deciding what to do with one's wonderful land of ours, but the real people, I'm still thrilled. Maybe David can live in a world of peace, not war. War and more war. Love, Sylvia."
David is in his 80s now. He turned 8 in 1948. And he tries to imagine his own mom thinking about him and actually writing that thought down, that he might live in a world without war.
"When you read that, you feel a little sad. But it was an exciting period for these people."
People with a lot of ideas, but to be fair, not a lot of power or influence. The one thing that they did have was a new union, Local 192. And as Nicholas Toloudis explains, that turned out to be pretty important. Within just 3 years, this group of teachers was leading the effort to pass Pennsylvania's first teacher tenure law.
What Local 92 did that was so unprecedented was that their tenure law was unusually empowering for teachers.
The tenure law would later play a devastating role in the lives of the teachers who helped pass it. But we're going to bookmark that for now. The immediate problem in Local 192 was infighting.
There were various factions.
Again, John Aaron Reich, son of Frieda and Joe.
They would talk about the constant battles over who the leadership would be. And I think at one point it was communist-led, and then it became socialist-led, and then it came back to being communist-led.
This is not an FBI conspiracy or McCarthy-era propaganda. Many of the people who helped form Philadelphia's first teachers' union were also, without question, communists.
You start to realize that the idealism of these teachers was not a joke. This was not feigned. This was for real. These were people who believed that they could participate in making the world a better place. They believed that communism was a vehicle to do that. Turns out they were wrong.
When Local 192 formed in the mid-1930s, we should note that the American Communist Party was on stronger footing. It was both larger than it is now, but also more closely allied with the rest of the nation's political left. That started to change as the excesses and horrors of the Stalin regime grew harder to ignore, and the rivalry between the U.S. and the Soviet Union escalated. As the early 1940s dawned, the party moved further and further toward pariah status, and that prompted an investigation from national union leaders at the American Federation of Teachers.
And eventually the national AFT, by 1939, realized we need to do something about this. And they launched what amounted to about a two-year-long internal investigation of both the New York and Philadelphia locals.
And if it wasn't already clear, it became obvious.
Oh, so maybe there is an organization outside of the AFT that is controlling some of our biggest affiliates.
In 1941, the National Union expelled Local 192 in Philadelphia. The non-communist left-wing teachers then created a new group, and that one ended up lasting. We know them today as the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers, aka the city's teachers union.
And that remains the name of the teachers union to this day.
Meanwhile, the communist group joined another national union and got booted again. After that, they tried to soldier on as an independent union, but by the 1950s, they had clearly lost the war. And soon, they were going to lose a lot more. As early as 1940, the FBI began to track Philadelphia teachers suspected of being communists.
The FBI would go through their trash sometimes. Sometimes it would work with the post office to intercept mail.
The Bureau ended up opening files on dozens of Philadelphia teachers. And no one knew, until everybody knew. Part 2. Crucible.
The difficulty arises that when communists take over a teacher's union, they are not only interested in the economic welfare and the welfare of the teachers, but they begin to use the union for a political purpose.
November 1953. That's the voice of Bella Dodd, coming from the same federal courtroom in Philadelphia where the accused teachers were questioned. Dodd was herself a former teacher in New York City and a strident communist before breaking with the party in the late 1940s. She then became an equally strident anti-communist and a star witness for HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee. She was here in Philadelphia to justify the proceedings.
I don't think the American people are aware of how deep this thing is, how all-pervasive, how it has practically permeated the very marrow of our bones.
HUAC had a problem. All of the Philadelphia teachers called before the committee had already signed a mandatory loyalty oath in 1952, swearing that they were no longer members of the Communist Party. And there was really no proof at all that any of them had violated the oath. Also, despite the FBI's surveillance, there wasn't any proof that Philadelphia teachers had actually preached communist doctrine in the classroom. So what threat did they actually pose? Dodd could explain.
It is absolutely impossible for a person to tear himself apart and say, I am a communist today, but I'm teaching geography or history tomorrow, and therefore I will teach the non-communist history or non-communist geography.
Dodd's case to the public was simple, really. If communism was in a teacher's heart, it would manifest in just about everything else that teacher did inside a school.
It's the things that you say in general, the way you greet the children, the time you spend with them in after school hours, the books you recommend, the newspaper items that you emphasize. You teach children and not subject matter. And that's where the communist teacher is very clever at putting forth her ideology and making it part of the pattern of the child's mind.
During the 1950s Red Scare, there were a pair of congressional committees that tried to root out communists from organizations where they allegedly held too much influence or could pose a risk to national security. Targets included the military, Hollywood, unions, and, crucially, schools.
Teachers, educators, those who are in touch with the rising generation are an extremely important group to them.
Philadelphia's Inquisition began very quietly, exactly 70 years ago, in 1952. That year, the superintendent of schools began summoning teachers to his office and asking about past communist ties. We don't really know what happened in all of those meetings, but we know that some teachers refused to answer questions. And we also know that until late 1953, the school district of Philadelphia sat on whatever information it had gathered. Then, a year later, HUAC came to town.
These television people are putting my address under my name in their announcement.
These HUAC hearings led the daily papers. They were covered live on radio and television. And in all, 33 Philadelphia school teachers testified before the committee, according to records kept by the local ACLU. About half of those teachers were questioned in Philadelphia, half during follow-up hearings in Washington. If you read the transcripts or hear the tapes, you're going to learn almost nothing about communism. Almost all the teachers refused to answer questions about their alleged involvement with the party. For many of the teachers, this was an exercise in containment. Speak plainly, say little, plead the fifth, go home.
We have sworn testimony, Mrs. Perloff, that in 1944, you were a member of the Communist Party and you held membership book number 78364. Is that correct?
I decline to answer under the protection of the Fifth Amendment.
There are times in these tapes when you can almost hear the witnesses trembling, like in the testimony of Caroline Perloff, in an interaction she had with Illinois Congressman and HUAC Chair Harold Veldy.
Could you raise your voice just a little bit? It's very difficult to hear in here.
I'll try to. I do have a fairly soft voice.
But other witnesses dug in, battling and frustrating the congressional committee. Nathan Margolis, an art teacher, tussled with his questioners for over half an hour. And at first, it's a little hard to understand what he's doing.
I wish not to refuse, but if you will permit me to continue in my own way...
Mr. Witness, you have previously been directed to answer or decline to answer...
So what did Margolis want? Turns out he wanted a chance to speak.
...questions you may care to ask me with
now,
respect
what are you reading
to myself.
From? What are you reading from?
A prepared statement, a prepared answer.
Finally, after about 20 minutes of verbal jousting, Margolis got an opening.
I am a loyal, law-abiding citizen, American citizen.
And in this moment, he stole about 2 minutes of time, a lone teacher's stand.
I'm an artist and a teacher. I'm not a political theorist or a politician. I have spent 27 years of my life teaching art in the public schools of Philadelphia and elsewhere. It is my belief and understanding that a teacher and an artist has a duty of personal integrity and conscience, and that the realm of ideas is protected from invasion by the government under the First Amendment to the Constitution. I do not wish to be a party to a proceeding which President Truman has aptly described as lacking in American concepts of fair play and due process of law, and which is characterized by the unfounded accusation and the big lie.
As he wound down, Margolis asked the committee if they would agree to a deal. If you agree to only ask questions about me, I'll answer them. The committee, as it had done for other witnesses, said no.
We've given you every privilege that any witness or any person deserves before this committee.
But
now, please show your patriotism.
Rolling. Yes.
Show your love of country if you have any.
I
and
do.
And answer this question yes
I do,
or no.
Dearly, and
or
I would like
refuse
to, ask
to
you for
answer.
A ruling. I would like to ask you for a ruling on this question to this committee.
Part 3. The Last Fight. The second-to-last teacher to testify in that Philadelphia courtroom, November 1953, was Herman Aaron Beelen. He was an English teacher and a 23-year veteran of the school system. He was being interrogated by Robert Kunzig, attorney for HUAC.
We have testimony that in 46 and in 47, you were an organizer of the professional section of the Communist Party of Eastern Pennsylvania and Delaware. Is that correct?
May I ask, if you have this information, why is it relevant that you ask me?
Judy Gandy watched her father being questioned on television from their home in Philadelphia's West Oak Lane neighborhood.
I was excited because how often do you see your father on television? I didn't really understand. I was fairly young, so I didn't really understand what the issue was. And I knew my mother was not excited. She was terrified.
Beelen was first summoned to the superintendent's office for questioning in June of 1952. It had been over a year since then, and beyond this public shaming, there had actually not been any direct consequences. All of the teachers still had jobs. But maybe Judy's mom, Evelyn, sensed that sword dangling above them.
It was not a happy time. There was a lot of tension in the house.
After the HUAC hearings, the wheels started to move. Quickly. 2 days after the committee left town, Friday, November 20th, 1953, John Ehrenreich was out to dinner with his parents, Joe and Frida, at one of those old automat restaurants.
There was a Horn and Hardart's on Germantown Avenue, which had something called Salisbury steak, which was one of the most god-awful things in the world, but which I loved.
The family ate dinner, went home, and turned on the radio.
And I don't know exactly what they said, but I remember one of my parents saying something like, it doesn't look good.
Then came a knock at the door with a telegram for his dad, Joe.
Saying that he was suspended from his job. And I just remember him sitting in an easy chair and at first just laughing. And obviously some kind of nervous release kind of laughing. And then getting up and getting a drink for himself. I mean, he was not a drinking man. And I think it was, other than an occasional party, I don't think I'd ever even seen him drink before. And I don't mean he got drunk, he had one drink. So that was the night.
When it was all over, the school district of Philadelphia suspended 26 teachers that night out of an eventual 32. The official reason for suspending these teachers was that they refused to answer questions about organizations, quote, whose purposes were inconsistent with the ideals to which our public schools subscribe.
You know, he had been teaching for 23 years and had got consistently positive evaluations and had played a major role in creating the tenure laws that supposedly protected teachers. And despite those laws, they came up with a pretense to fire him.
Remember that tenure law? The one that a lot of these same teachers helped to pass during the early union days. Well, by 1952, the law had been revised, but the practice of tenure for classroom teachers was well established. And in a twist of fate, that tenure law, became a tool for Philadelphia's Board of Education to remove political undesirables from their classrooms. The tenure law said that a teacher could be fired for incompetence. Philadelphia made the argument that by refusing to answer certain questions about their political affiliations, the teachers had proven themselves incompetent. So, was that legal? After many defeats dating back to 1941, the communist-aligned teachers saw this latest plight as a galvanizing opportunity, a chance to kind of keep the gang together. They were now this independent group known simply as the Philadelphia Teachers Union, and they tried to mount a defense. Professor Nick Talutis says the focus of their efforts was a lawsuit, starting with one teacher.
What was left of the Philadelphia Teachers Union tried really hard to raise money for High Bielan's legal fees. They took that case seriously.
Herman Bielan had sued the school district to overturn his firing. Back in 1952, the U.S. Supreme Court had upheld the firing of a New York City teacher under similar circumstances. Bielan was hoping to reverse that precedent, hoping that the high court would say he had a constitutionally protected right to his job, even if he refused to answer questions about his communist past. And in 1958, the U.S. Supreme Court actually took up his case.
Mr. Carroll, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Maybe it is something of a victory that Bielan's case made it all the way to the Supreme Court, but the case itself was a dead end. In June 1958, the High Court ruled 5-4 in favor of the school district. As legal scholar Marjorie Hines explains, the majority decision largely sidestepped the central issues.
It was really the court's political reaction.
Hines thinks that the Bielan case was a victim of bad timing. A year earlier, the court handed down 4 decisions that favored communist plaintiffs in free speech cases. After a public backlash, Hines thinks the court wanted to tiptoe backward.
We were taught these notions of, you know, judges are neutral and they decide on neutral principles. And then when you get into the trenches and you start really following the history, especially this particular history, the hysteria, the Cold War hysteria that gripped the United States, you know, you see that they flip, you know, they come to the results based on their political feelings at the time.
Bielan had lost. And the road had also finally ended for the group now calling itself the Philadelphia Teachers Union. Again, here's Professor Nick Talutis.
I think a number of them were like, yeah, we can't keep fighting this battle.
More than 20 years after they'd first formed and 17 years after they'd first been tossed from a national union, the group had run out of reincarnations. Talutis found one final letter from 1963.
But the letter basically said, we're no longer trying to raise money. So thank you for trying. Thank you for trying to work with us.
The union disappeared. Of course, the people in it didn't. They had lives to lead and lives to reinvent.
You go through this traumatic experience in 52, 53, 54. And then what?
Part 4, Rebirth.
The witnesses refuse to talk. Instead, they say nothing. One can only draw the conclusion that though many witnesses have emphasized that they are not today members of the Communist Party, they do not wish to help destroy the communist conspiracy.
Let's go back quickly to November of 1953. HUAC Chair Harold Velde is closing out 3 days of hearings in Philadelphia. That's his final statement, and it really smacked of defeat. The hearings had revealed almost nothing about communism in Philadelphia's schools such as it existed.
The committee will stand in adjournment at this time until further notice.
HUAC may not have achieved its stated goals, but it had certainly done something. It upended the lives of the teachers in its crosshairs.
It's not happening to abstract people. It's happening to people who have a family and have lives.
People like John Ehrenreich, whose dad Joe lost his job at the end of 1953.
But meanwhile, their life is also going on. You know, children are born and grandparents die and things happen.
A lot of things happen to the Ehrenreich family. In the late 1940s, John's dad, Joe, had gotten sick with tuberculosis and had to spend long stretches in a sanatorium. When that happened, his mom, Frieda, went back to work as a guidance counselor. For whatever reason, no one knows, the school district never tried to fire Frieda, even though she had certainly been involved with the Communist Party. So in 1953, she got to keep her job. And then...
the following year, fall of 54, my mother has a near-fatal heart attack.
A mom who can't work, a dad who cannot find work.
So certainly one of my memories is we were pretty poor. And we were... did continue to get some help from my uncles and from some of the family friends. But things were tight.
For some of these teachers, the events set off by the HUAC interrogation seemed to throw their lives completely off axis. One of those teachers was a woman named Sophie Elfont.
Sophie is spelled S-O-P-H-I-E, Elfont, capital E-L-F-O-N-T.
During Elfont's testimony before HUAC, which you heard just there, the committee's lawyer at one point asked about her employment history. Clearly, she was a little nervous, and she asked the lawyer if he literally wanted to hear about every place that she had worked.
Shall I read them just as they are here?
All right, just give us the facts.
Maybe more than anything else in these tapes, that laughter gives you a sense of the room. The contempt that the people must have felt for those testifying. Even quiet Sophie Elfont, described in the newspaper as plump and bespectacled, garnered little sympathy. To those watching, her nerves must have seemed like a sign of guilt instead of a sign of fear.
Have you ever been a member of that party?
I decline to answer that, the Fifth Amendment.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Sophie Elfont never married or had any children. This is her nephew, Mark Elfont.
She was a remarkable person. She was very, very bright.
Bright and caring, and as best as I can tell, really not well suited to withstand the attention that came with her firing. Afterward, her world seemed to narrow. Sophie lived alone in Philadelphia's Germantown section.
She had a very small, ramshackle type of apartment. It was devastating for her.
Another relative told me that she scratched out a living working for a clipping service. Basically, what she'd do is she'd scour the newspaper every day, literally cutting out articles that had some relevance to her clients.
So she was able to, you know, maintain her independence, but it wasn't easy. She certainly did not have an easy life.
Sophie died in 1987.
She was dead for like something like 2 days before somebody found out about it. But that's, you know, because she was somewhat isolated and she had dedicated her body to science. So there was no funeral or anything else.
There is a temptation, I think, to focus on the tragedy here, maybe as a way to indict the government to show how reckless these persecutions were. But to leave you with just those stories would be misleading. Because many of the teachers had rich and varied lives in the decades that followed. Nathan Margolis's wife, Adele, a former teacher, wrote several beloved books on sewing. John Ehrenreich's dad, Joe, had a long career as a technical writer. The union's last president, Francis Jennings, became a lauded historian. And maybe the most interesting post-HUAC life belongs to a woman named Goldie Watson, one of the few black teachers fired. I was not able to reach any of her surviving relatives, but we know from newspapers that Watson became a prominent public servant in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And her career culminated with an ideological twist. She became a prominent deputy for conservative Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo. So, a lot of lives, a lot of paths. Did the firings devastate these teachers? Did they strengthen their resolve? As it usually does, the truth lands somewhere in between.
And I can start at the beginning and go chronological if you want or whatever.
That is the voice of Joe Intilli.
Intilli, I-N-T-I-L-L-E.
I reached Joe on the phone from his home in Florida. Joe was born in 1939, old enough that he remembers his mom's suspension and eventual firing in the early 1950s. Joe's mom, Angelina, grew up in South Philadelphia with nine siblings.
And none of them went to college.
Angelina was a little different, more studious. She ended up falling in with a group of mostly Jewish kids from the neighborhood, and a lot of them ended up in the same profession.
You know, most of her friends were all this close-knit group of mostly Jewish school teachers and educators.
I want to be fair here and mention that Joe does not think that his mom was an active member of the Communist Party, just that she was part of the same crowd. Joe's dad was decidedly not part of that crowd.
You know, he was one of these macho Italian guys that, she was young and very much enamored with him.
At least in the beginning. But Joe says his dad had a gambling problem and also abused his mom. So one day, Joe thinks 1946, 1947.
She packed up when he was at work and basically just moved out. And we moved in with her friend, whose name was Bessie Stinsky, who was also involved in this McCarthy business.
And that is the world that Joe grew up in. The names splashed across the front page of the newspapers in 1953 were the people who helped to raise him. People like fired teacher Eleanor Fleet and her husband Irv.
Irv served as kind of a male role model for me. And he got me interested in science and technology.
The field Joe eventually worked in. When Angelina lost her job in 1953 and the family needed money, she and several other fired teachers got jobs together at a private school for students with special needs. Another group was hired at a progressive independent school called Mequon. And still another teacher started an extermination business.
And when I was in high school, I worked for him as an exterminator for a number of years.
I heard a lot of stories like this. Kids of fired teachers working for each other's parents, hanging out, even going to prom together. HUAC hadn't blown them apart.
It bonded them.
Even though the union itself was in various states of decay, as a network of people, it remained intact, well after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against Herman Bielan.
To have a group like that, you know, like 50 people, who ever heard of such a thing?
I'm not sure whether to call this next part the final chapter, or maybe it's the epilogue. But in 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court took up a case about a Buffalo professor at a state university who was fired for refusing to sign a loyalty oath. And in that case, the court reversed a precedent it had established in the early days of the Red Scare, all the way back in 1952. Invoking this concept of academic freedom, the court said that the Constitution did protect teachers like the ones fired in Philadelphia. It was close, a 5-4 decision, but it meant that the saga was over. A few months later, a tiny article ran on page 17 of the Philadelphia Inquirer. The headline, "Schools Rehire Four Who Balked at Red Probe." Now, most of the teachers had moved on, but a handful actually applied for reinstatement and simply went back to work nearly 14 years after they'd been suspended. One of them was Judy Gandy's father, Herman Bielan.
If I were faced with the same decision, I would just say, bye-bye. I would not want to be part of this organization anymore, but clearly he wanted it.
Judy thinks that money was probably a factor, but also her dad just loved teaching.
He was completely committed to teaching. And even when he was not in a classroom, he was teaching. He would teach me at home.
Herman Bielan was in his late 50s by the time he resumed his public school teaching career. Judy remembers he would take the city bus to work every morning, and he would bring the newspaper along with him, folded up in quarters.
He had a very special way of folding it so that it was easy to read on the bus, so that he wouldn't be going like this and bothering other people, but he was trying to occupy his brain, which is kind of standard for him.
Beelin and his friends were fired on the front page of the newspaper and rehired on page 17. The world had moved on, and in some ways, that's probably why they were rehired. By the late 1960s, there were new fronts in the culture war. As time passed, those fronts moved further and further from people like Herman Beelin. When Beelin died in 1981, the Inquirer ran an obituary on page 31. It didn't mention his firing or the Supreme Court case that bears his name. Joe's mom, Angelina Intilli, also went back to work as a teacher, finished off her career. But just because she ended up back where she started doesn't mean the family came through unscathed.
It affected both my life and my older brother's life quite a bit over the course of the years.
I mentioned earlier that Joe had grown up around this group of teachers, which spurred his love of science. Joe ended up in the Navy, and then after that, working jobs that required national security clearances. Those clearances proved difficult to get because of his mom's past.
And they're sitting up on this big counter up there, and I'm sitting down in this little chair, and they're grilling me about my mother and myself, and why should I get a clearance?
Around 1965, Joe says he actually lost a job because he couldn't get a clearance. Ended up working in insurance for a couple of years. Finally, to get his career back, he made a promise to the U.S. government.
I had to promise them that I would not associate with my mother anymore. Now, this is many years after all of this.
Joe's older brother joined the Air Force and ended up with the same dilemma. For Joe's brother, it ended up being a breaking point.
In fact, it left a very bad taste in my brother's mouth about my mom. And he basically held it against my mom and never forgave her for any of that.
But even though Joe himself suffered the exact same consequences, he felt the opposite.
I'm not ashamed of any of this. As a matter of fact, I brag about it too, because I was proud of my mom. She stood by her principles.
And as for that promise he made to the feds about cutting his mom out of his life, Joe says he never intended to keep it.
No. My mother's my best friend.
Angelina eventually retired and moved to Florida. She died in 2004. I did notice that a lot of the teachers died in South Florida, which meant very little to me initially because, let's face it, a lot of people that age retire to Florida. But I later learned that this was more than just a coincidence.
They then all moved, and I mean all of them, all moved up to Lake Worth, and they all moved into the same condo complexes.
It turned out that a core group of these teachers ended up retiring together.
It was about 20 people.
One child of the fired teachers told me that he would go down there to visit, and all of these old teachers would be sitting around the pool talking about the glory days of communism. It's a funny image, maybe more than a little ironic, but it's also telling. 30, 40 years after the government called them a threat to the nation, here they were, lounging in the Florida sun. They'd made it through, and they'd made it through together. Part 5, when the tape stops.
The committee will stand adjourned.
You can lose history, and then you can find it again. But what do you do when you find it? What do you do with the discovery? Lots of the relatives who I interviewed for this story asked some version of that question, and a lot of them also tried to answer it. Here's John Ehrenreich.
I think that historical memory is important. And I think that in many ways, Americans are cut off from their own history.
You may recognize the names of some of the school board members who actually fired these teachers. Joseph Greenberg, William Lesh, J. Harry LeBrum. All of them have schools named after them in Philadelphia. So maybe there's virtue in just retelling a story covered up by the sands of time, if only to even the score a bit in terms of public memory. and spark conversations that need sparking. Then you have to have those conversations, and everything gets a little trickier. I mentioned earlier that Herman Bielan's Supreme Court case was ultimately insignificant, at least in the narrow sense of legal precedent. But if you listen back to the oral argument, you will find the justices grappling with ideas that feel current. Like, what if you just start firing communist teachers?
Now, where is the dividing line? How can you say to me that it would be wrong to ask him about being a Republican? It's very doubtful whether it would be, or it is at least doubtful whether you could ask him about the Progressive Party, and totally proper to ask about the Communist Party.
Now, on the other hand, if you say a school district cannot fire former communists, does that mean you have to allow teachers with any kind of political affiliation?
Would you have asked him whether he was a member of the Klan?
Under my theory, sir?
Yes.
I think not.
Not. All right.
These questions inevitably lead to more questions. Do we have to decide which groups people can belong to and still teach? Can that list change over time? You will each have your own answers. But the fact that these Philadelphia teachers were fired for their political associations should tell us something about ourselves and our country. Again, Professor Nicholas Taloudis.
It speaks to the very genuine, I mean, whether it's justified or not is another matter, but the very genuine fears about communist subversion in the United States in so sensitive an area of American life.
In this nation, we do not have a common skin tone or a common religion. If we have anything in common, it's a civic religion. And you're not born into that. You have to be taught, probably, in school.
Teachers are doing the work to inculcate Americanism.
And that sounds like pretty important work, doesn't it? And it sounds like the person doing that work is the kind of person you might target when you feel some aspect of Americanism as you understand it slipping away. You can follow that impulse to some pretty dark places. And if nothing else, maybe it's just worth sitting with that thought.
Are you presently a teacher in the Philadelphia school system, Mr. Kaplan?
I am.
Where do you teach?
I teach at the John Bartram High School.
What subject do you teach?
Schooled is produced by WHYY in Philadelphia. This episode was written by me, Avi Wolfman-Arendt. It was edited by Mike and Scott, Emily Rizzo, Michaela Winberg, and Danya Henninger. Engineer Charlie Kyer helped mix the sound. The tapes you heard in this episode were brought back to life by George Blood LP. Special thanks to the descendants who shared their stories with me, who took the time to explain how history echoes down through the generations. Alan Soler, Ani Abeglin, Bernie Ivins, Bill Simon, David Mahaney, Frida Egnall, Mark Egnall, Harvey Fleet, Peter Fernberger, Angela Schwartz, and the Grossman Gang, Derek, John, and Owen. I also want to highlight one more time Judy Gandy and Nick Taloudis. This episode would not have been possible without your wisdom, your openness, and the stunning audio that you helped preserve. WHYY's Vice President of News is John Massoni. And finally, a thank you to Kevin McCory, the man who invented Schooled and established its legacy of great storytelling. We hope, Kevin, that we are doing you proud. For more on this episode, visit whyy.org/schooled. Later in this season of Schooled, we have a story about modern-day censorship in schools. But first, we're going to look at a group of teachers who haven't been fired, but may quit on their own. Stay tuned.